I poured 2 cups of coffee and gave one to him. "It's all right," I said. "Wes, don't worry about it," I said. I sat down on Chef's sofa with my coffee. "Fat Linda's going to live here now instead of us," Wes said. He held his cup, but he didn't drink from it. "Wes, don't get stirred up," I said. "Her man will turn up in Ketchikan," Wes said. "Fat Linda's husband has simply pulled out on them." "And who could blame him?" Wes said. Wes said if it came to that, he'd go down with his ship, too, rather than live the rest of his days with Fat Linda and her kid. Then Wes put his cup down next to his gloves. "This has been a happy house up to now," he said. "We'll get another house," I said. "Not like this one," Wes said. "It wouldn't be the same anyway. This house has been a good house for us. This house has good memories to it. Now Fat Linda and her kid will be in here," Wes said. He picked up his cup and tasted from it. "It's Chef's house," I said. "He has to do what he has to do." "I know that," Wes said, "but I don't have to like it." Wes had this look about him. I knew that look. He kept touching his lips with his tongue. He kept thumbing his shirt under his waistband. He got up from the chair and went to the window. He stood looking out at the ocean and at the clouds which were building up. He patted his chin with his fingers like he was thinking about something. And he was thinking. "Go easy, Wes," I said. "She wants me to go easy," Wes said. He kept standing there. But in a minute he came over and sat next to me on the sofa. He crossed one leg over the other and began fooling with the buttons on his shirt. I took his hand. I started to talk. I talked about the summer, but I caught myself talking like it was something that had happened in the past, maybe years back, at any rate, like something that was over. Then I started talking about the kids. Wes said he wished he could do it over again and do it right this time. "They love you," I said. "No, they don't," he said. I said, "someday they'll understand things." "Maybe," Wes said, "but it won't matter then." "You don't know," I said. "I know a few things," Wes said, and looked at me. "I know I'm glad you came up here. I won't forget you did it," Wes said. "I'm glad, too," I said. "I'm glad you found this house," I said. Wes snorted. Then he laughed. We both laughed. "That chef," Wes said and shook his head. "He threw us a knuckleball, that son of a bitch. But I'm glad you wore your ring. I'm glad we had this time together," Wes said. Then I said something. I said, "Suppose, just suppose, nothing had ever happened. Suppose this was for the first time. Just suppose. It doesn't hurt to suppose. Say none of the other had ever happened. You know what I mean?" "Then what?" I said. Wes fixed his eyes on me. He said, "Then I suppose we'd have to be somebody else if that was the case. Somebody we're not. I don't have that kind of supposing left in me. We were born who we are. Don't you see what I'm saying?" I said I hadn't thrown away a good thing and come 600 miles to hear him talk like this. He said, "I'm sorry, but I can't talk like somebody I'm not. I'm not somebody else. If I was somebody else, I sure as hell wouldn't be here. If I was somebody else, I wouldn't be me. But I'm who I am. Don't you see?" "Wes, it's all right," I said. I brought his hand to my cheek. Then, I don't know, I remembered how he was when he was 19. The way he looked running across this field to where his dad sat on a tractor, hand over his eyes, watching Wes run toward him. We'd just driven up from California. I got out with Cheryl and Bobby and said, "There's Grandpa." But they were just babies. Wes sat next to me, patting his chin, like he was trying to figure out the next thing. Wes's dad was gone, and our kids were grown up. I looked at Wes, and then I looked around Chef's living room at Chef's things, and I thought, "We have to do something now, and do it quick." "Hon," I said, "Wes, Listen to me. What do you want? He said. But that's all he said. He seemed to have made up his mind. But having made up his mind, he was in no hurry. He leaned back on the sofa, folded his hands in his lap, and closed his eyes. He didn't say anything else. He didn't have to. I said his name to myself. It was an easy name to say, and I'd been used to saying it for a long time. Then I said it once more. This time I said it out loud. Wes, I said. He opened his eyes, but he didn't look at me. He just sat where he was and looked toward the window. Fat Linda, he said. But I knew it wasn't her. She was nothing, just a name. Wes got up and pulled the drapes, and the ocean was gone, just like that. I went in to start supper. We still had some fish in the icebox. There wasn't much else. We'll clean it up tonight, I thought, and that will be the end of it. Preservation. Sandy's husband had been on the sofa ever since he'd been terminated 3 months ago. That day, 3 months ago, he'd come home looking pale and scared and with all of his work things in a box. "Happy Valentine's Day," he said to Sandy, and put a heart-shaped box of candy and a bottle of Jim Beam on the kitchen table. He took off his cap and laid that on the table, too. "I got canned today. Hey, what do you think's going to happen to us now?" Sandy and her husband sat at the table and drank whiskey and ate the chocolates. They talked about what he might be able to do instead of putting roofs on new houses. But they couldn't think of anything. "Something will turn up," Sandy said. She wanted to be encouraging, but she was scared, too. Finally, he said he'd sleep on it. And he did. He made his bed on the sofa that night, and that's where he'd slept every night since it had happened. The day after his termination, there were unemployment benefits to see about. He went downtown to the state office to fill out papers and look for another job. But there were no jobs in his line of work, or in any other line of work. His face began to sweat as he tried to describe to Sandy the milling crowd of men and women down there. That evening, he got back on the sofa. He began spending all of his time there, as if, she thought, it was the thing he was supposed to do now that he no longer had any work. Once in a while, he had to go talk to somebody about a job possibility, and every 2 weeks he had to go sign something to collect his unemployment compensation. But the rest of the time, he stayed on the sofa. "It's like he lives there," Sandy thought. "He lives in the living room." Now and then he looked through magazines she brought home from the grocery store, and every so often she came in to find him looking at this big book she'd got as a bonus for joining a book club, something called Mysteries of the Past. He held the book in front of him with both hands, his head inclined over the pages as if he were being drawn in by what he was reading. But after a while, she noticed that he didn't seem to be making any progress in it. He still seemed to be at about the same place, somewhere around chapter 2, she guessed. Sandy picked it up once and opened it to his place. There she read about a man who had been discovered after spending 2,000 years in a peat bog in the Netherlands. A photograph appeared on one page. The man's brow was furrowed, but there was a serene expression to his face. He wore a leather cap and lay on his side. The man's hands and feet had shriveled, but otherwise he didn't look so awful. She read in the book a little further, then put it back where she had gotten it. Her husband kept it within easy reach on the coffee table that stood in front of the sofa. That goddamn sofa! As far as she was concerned, she didn't even want to sit on it again. She couldn't imagine them ever having lain down there in the past to make love. The newspaper came to the house every day. He read it from the first page to the last. She saw him read everything right down to the obituary section and the part showing the temperatures of the major cities, as well as the business news section, which told about mergers and interest rates. Mornings, he got up before she did and used the bathroom. Then he turned the TV on and made coffee. She thought he seemed upbeat and cheerful at that hour of the day. But by the time she left for work, he'd made his place on the sofa and the TV was going. Most often, it would still be going when she came in again that afternoon. He'd be sitting up on the sofa, or else lying down on it, dressed in what he used to wear to work, jeans and a flannel shirt. But sometimes the TV would be off, and he'd be sitting there holding his book. "How's it going?" he'd say when she looked in on him. "Okay," she'd say. "How's it with you?" "Okay." He always had a pot of coffee warming on the stove for her. In the living room, she'd sit in the big chair and he'd sit on the sofa while they talked about her day. They'd hold their cups and drink their coffee as if they were normal people, Sandy thought. Sandy still loved him, even though she knew things were getting weird. She was thankful to have her job, but she didn't know what was going to happen to them or to anybody else in the world. She had a girlfriend at work she confided in one time about her husband, about his being on the sofa all the time. For some reason, her friend didn't seem to think it was anything very strange, which both surprised and depressed Sandy. Her friend told her about her uncle in Tennessee. When her uncle had turned 40, he got into his bed and wouldn't get up any more, and he cried a lot. He cried at least once a day. She told Sandy she guessed her uncle was afraid of getting old. She guessed maybe he was afraid of a heart attack or something. But the man was 63 now and still breathing, she said. When Sandy heard this, she was stunned. If this woman was telling the truth, she thought, the man has been in bed for 23 years. Sandy's husband was only 31. 31 and 23 is 54. That'd put her in her 50s then, too. My God, a person couldn't live the whole rest of his life in bed, or else on the sofa. If her husband had been wounded or was ill, or had been hurt in a car accident, that'd be different. She could understand that. If something like that was the case, she knew she could bear it. Then, if he had to live on the sofa, and she had to bring him his food out there, maybe carry the spoon up to his mouth, there was even something like romance in that kind of thing. But for her husband, a young and otherwise healthy man, to take to the sofa in this way and not want to get up, except to go to the bathroom, or to turn the TV on in the morning, or off at night, this was different. It made her ashamed. And except for that one time, she didn't talk about it to anybody. She didn't say any more about it to her friend, whose uncle had gotten into bed 23 years ago and was still there, as far as Sandy knew. Late one afternoon, she came home from work, parked the car, and went inside the house. She could hear the TV going in the living room as she let herself in the door to the kitchen. The coffee pot was on the stove, and the burner was on low. From where she stood in the kitchen, holding her purse, she could look into the living room and see the back of the sofa and the TV screen. Figures moved across the screen. Her husband's bare feet stuck out from one end of the sofa. At the other end, on a pillow which lay across the arm of the sofa, she could see the crown of his head. He didn't stir. He may or may not have been asleep, and he may or may not have heard her come in. But she decided it didn't make any difference one way or the other. She put her purse on the table and went over to the fridge to get herself some yogurt. But when she opened the door, warm, boxed-in air came out at her. She couldn't believe the mess inside. The ice cream from the freezer had melted and run down into the leftover fish sticks and coleslaw. Ice cream had gotten into the bowl of Spanish rice and pooled on the bottom of the fridge. Ice cream was everywhere. She opened the door to the freezer compartment. An awful smell puffed out at her that made her want to gag. Ice cream covered the bottom of the compartment and puddled around a 3-pound package of hamburger. She pressed her finger into the cellophane wrapper covering the meat, and her finger sank into the package. The pork chops had thawed, too. Everything had thawed, including some more fish sticks, a package of steakums, and 2 Chef Sammy Chinese food dinners. The hot dogs and homemade spaghetti sauce had thawed. She closed the door to the freezer and reached into the fridge for her carton of yogurt. She raised the lid on the yogurt and sniffed. That's when she yelled at her husband. "What is it?" he said, sitting up and looking over the back of the sofa. "Hey, what's wrong?" He pushed his hand through his hair a couple of times. She couldn't tell if he'd been asleep all this time or what. "The goddamn fridge has gone out," Sandy said. "That's what." Her husband got up off the sofa and lowered the volume on the TV. Then he turned it off and came out to the kitchen. "Let me see this," he said. "Hey, I don't believe this." "See for yourself," she said. "Everything's going to spoil." Her husband looked inside the fridge, and his face assumed a very grave expression. Then he poked around in the freezer and saw what things were like in there. "Tell me, what next?" he said. A bunch of things suddenly flew into her head, but she didn't say anything. "God damn," he said, "when it rains, it pours. Hey, this fridge can't be more than 10 years old. It was nearly new when we bought it. Listen, my folks had a fridge that lasted them 25 years. They gave it to my brother when he got married. It was working fine. Hey, what's going on?" He moved over so that he could see into the narrow space between the fridge and the wall. "I don't get it," he said, and shook his head. "It's plugged in." Then he took hold of the fridge and rocked it back and forth. He put his shoulder against it and pushed and jerked the appliance a few inches out into the kitchen. Something inside the fridge fell off a shelf and broke. "Hell's bells," he said. Sandy realized she was still holding the yogurt. She went over to the garbage can, raised the lid, and dropped the carton inside. "I have to cook everything tonight," she said. She saw herself at the stove frying meat, fixing things in pans on the stove and in the oven. "We need a new fridge," she said. He didn't say anything. He looked into the freezer compartment once more and turned his head back and forth. She moved in front of him and started taking things off the shelves and putting stuff on the table. He helped. He took the meat out of the freezer and put the packages on the table. Then he took the other things out of the freezer and put them in a different place on the table. He took everything out and then found the paper towels and the dishcloth and started wiping up inside. "We lost our Freon," he said, and stopped wiping. "That's what happened. I can smell it. The Freon leaked out. Something happened, and the Freon went. Hey, I saw this happen to somebody else's box once." He was calm now. He started wiping again. "It's the Freon," he said. She stopped what she was doing and looked at him. "We need another fridge," she said. "You said that. Hey, where are we going to get one? They don't grow on trees." "We have to have one," she said. "Don't we need a fridge? Maybe we don't. Maybe we can keep our perishables on the windowsill like those people in tenements do. Or else we could get one of those little styrofoam coolers and buy some ice every day." She put a head of lettuce and some tomatoes on the table next to the packages of meat. Then she sat down on one of the dinette chairs and brought her hands up to her face. "We'll get us another fridge," her husband said. "Hell yes. We need one, don't we? We can't get along without one. The question is, where do we get one, and how much can we pay for it? There must be zillions of used ones in the classifieds. Just hold on, and we'll see what's in the paper. Hey, I'm an expert on the classifieds," he said. She brought her hands down from her face and looked at him. Sandy will find us a good used box out of the paper, he went on. Most of your fridges are built to last a lifetime. This one of ours, Jesus, I don't know what happened to it. It's only the second one in my life I ever heard about going on the fritz like this. He switched his gaze to the fridge again. Goddamn lousy luck, he said. Bring the paper out here, she said. Let's see what there is. Don't worry, he said. He went to the coffee table, sorted through the stack of newspapers, and came back to the kitchen with the classified section. She pushed the food to one side so that he could spread the pages out. He took one of the chairs. She glanced down at the paper, then at the food that had thawed. I've got to fry pork chops tonight, she said, and I have to cook up that hamburger, and those sandwich steaks and the fish sticks. Don't forget the TV dinners, either. That goddamn Freon, he said. You can smell it. They began to go through the classifieds. He ran his finger down one column and then another. He passed quickly over the jobs available section. She saw checks beside a couple of things, but she didn't look to see what he'd marked. It didn't matter. There was a column headline, Outdoor Camping Supplies. Then they found it. Appliances, new and used. Here, she said, and put her finger down on the paper. He moved her finger. Let me see, he said. She put her finger back where it had been. Refrigerators, ranges, washers, dryers, etc., she said, reading from the ad boxed in the column. Auction barn. What's that? Auction barn, she went on reading. New and used appliances and more every Thursday night. Auction at 7 o'clock. That's today. Today's Thursday, she said. This auction's tonight, and this place is not very far away. It's down on Pine Street. I must have driven by 100 times. You too. You know where it is. It's down there close to that Baskin Robbins. Her husband didn't say anything. He stared at the ad. He brought his hand up and pulled at his lower lip with two of his fingers. Auction barn, he said. She fixed her eyes on him. Let's go to it. What do you say? It'll do you good to get out, and we'll see if we can find us a fridge. Two birds with one stone, she said. I've never been to an auction in my life, he said, and I don't believe I want to go to one now. Come on, Sandy said. What's the matter with you? They're fun. I haven't been to one in years, not since I was a kid. I used to go to them with my dad. She suddenly wanted to go to this auction very much. Your dad, he said. Yeah, my dad. She looked at her husband, waiting for him to say something else, the least thing, but he didn't. Auctions are fun, she said. They probably are, but I don't want to go. I need a bed lamp, too, she went on. They'll have bed lamps. Hey, we need lots of things, but I don't have a job, remember? I'm going to this auction, she said, whether you go or not. You might as well come along, but I don't care. If you want the truth, it's immaterial to me, but I'm going. I'll go with you. Who said I wouldn't go? He looked at her and then looked away. He picked up the paper and read the ad again. I don't know the first thing about auctions, but sure, I'll try anything once. Whoever said anything about us buying an icebox at an auction? Nobody, she said, but we'll do it anyway. Okay, he said. Good, she said, but only if you really want to. He nodded. She said, I guess I'd better start cooking. I'll cook the goddamn pork chops now and we'll eat. The rest of this stuff can wait. I'll cook everything else later, after we go to this auction. But we have to get moving. The paper said 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock, he said. He got up from the table and made his way into the living room, where he looked out the bay window for a minute. A car passed on the street outside. He brought his fingers up to his lip. She watched him sit down on the sofa and take up his book. He opened it to his place. But in a minute he put it down and lay back on the sofa. She saw his head come down on the pillow that lay across the arm of the sofa. He adjusted the pillow under his head and put his hands behind his neck. Then he lay still. Pretty soon she saw his arms move down to his sides. She folded the paper. She got up from the chair and went quietly out to the living room, where she looked over the back of the sofa. His eyes were shut. His chest seemed to barely rise and then fall. She went back to the kitchen and put a frying pan on the burner. She turned the burner on and poured oil into the pan. She started frying pork chops. She'd gone to auctions with her dad. Most of those auctions had to do with farm animals. She seemed to remember her dad was always trying to sell a calf, or else buy one. Sometimes there'd be farm equipment and household items at the auctions, but mostly it was farm animals. Then, after her dad and mom had divorced, and she'd gone away to live with her mom, her dad wrote to say he missed going to auctions with her. The last letter he wrote to her, after she'd grown up and was living with her husband, he said he'd bought a peach of a car at this auction for $200. If she'd been there, he said, he'd have bought one for her, too. 3 weeks later, in the middle of the night, a telephone call told her that he was dead. The car he'd bought leaked carbon monoxide up through the floorboards and caused him to pass out behind the wheel. He lived in the country. The motor went on running until there was no more gas in the tank. He stayed in the car until somebody found him a few days later. The pan was starting to smoke. She poured in more oil and turned on the fan. She hadn't been to an auction in 20 years, and now she was getting ready to go to one tonight. But first she had to fry these pork chops. It was bad luck their fridge had gone fluey, but she found herself looking forward to this auction. She began missing her dad. She even missed her mom now, though the two of them used to argue all the time before she met her husband and began living with him. She stood at the stove, turning the meat, and missing both her dad and her mom. Still missing them, she took a potholder and moved the pan off the stove. Smoke was being drawn up through the vent over the stove. She stepped to the doorway with the pan and looked into the living room. The pan was still smoking, and drops of oil and grease jumped over the sides as she held it. In the darkened room, she could just make out her husband's head and his bare feet. "Come on out here," she said. "It's ready."
"Okay," he said.
She saw his head come up from the end of the sofa. She put the pan back on the stove and turned to the cupboard. She took down a couple of plates and put them on the counter. She used her spatula to raise one of the pork chops. Then she lifted it onto a plate. The meat didn't look like meat. It looked like part of an old shoulder blade or a digging instrument. But she knew it was a pork chop, and she took the other one out of the pan and put that on a plate, too. In a minute, her husband came into the kitchen. He looked at the fridge once more, which was standing there with its door open, and then his eyes took in the pork chops. His mouth dropped open, but he didn't say anything. She waited for him to say something, anything, but he didn't. She put salt and pepper on the table and told him to sit down. "Sit down," she said, and gave him a plate on which lay the remains of a pork chop. "I want you to eat this," she said. He took the plate, but he just stood there and looked at it. Then she turned to get her own plate. Sandy cleared the newspaper away and shoved the food to the far side of the table. "Sit down," she said to her husband once more. He moved his plate from one hand to the other, but he kept standing there. It was then she saw puddles of water on the table. She heard water, too. It was dripping off the table and onto the linoleum. She looked down at her husband's bare feet. She stared at his feet next to the pool of water. She knew she'd never again in her life see anything so unusual. But she didn't know what to make of it yet. She thought she'd better put on some lipstick, get her coat, and go ahead to the auction. But she couldn't take her eyes from her husband's feet. She put her plate on the table and watched until the feet left the kitchen and went back into the living room. The compartment. Myers was traveling through France in a first-class rail car on his way to visit his son in Strasbourg, who was a student at the university there. He hadn't seen the boy in 8 years. There had been no phone calls between them during this time, not even a postcard, since Myers and the boy's mother had gone their separate ways, the boy staying with her. The final breakup was hastened along, Myers always believed, by the boy's malign interference in their personal affairs. The last time Myers had seen his son, the boy had lunged for him during a violent quarrel. Myers's wife had been standing by the sideboard, dropping one dish of china after the other onto the dining room floor. Then she'd gone on to the cups. "That's enough," Myers had said, and at that instant the boy charged him. Myers sidestepped and got him in a headlock, while the boy wept and pummeled Myers on the back and kidneys. Myers had him, and while he had him, he made the most of it. He slammed him into the wall and threatened to kill him. He meant it. "I gave you your life," Myers remembered himself shouting, "and I can take it back." Thinking about that horrible scene now, Myers shook his head as if it had happened to someone else. And it had. He was simply not the same person. These days he lived alone and had little to do with anybody outside of his work. At night, he listened to classical music and read books on waterfowl decoys. He lit a cigarette and continued to gaze out the train window, ignoring the man who sat in the seat next to the door and who slept with a hat pulled over his eyes. It was early in the morning, and mist hung over the green fields that passed by outside. Now and then Myers saw a farmhouse and its outbuildings, everything surrounded by a wall. He thought this might be a good way to live, in an old house surrounded by a wall. It was just past 6 o'clock. Myers hadn't slept since he'd boarded the train in Milan at 11 the night before. When the train had left Milan, he'd considered himself lucky to have the compartment to himself. He kept the light on and looked at guidebooks. He read things he wished he'd read before he'd been to the place they were about. He discovered much that he should have seen and done. In a way, he was sorry to be finding out certain things about the country now, just as he was leaving Italy behind after his first and, no doubt, last visit. He put the guidebooks away in his suitcase, put the suitcase in the overhead rack, and took off his coat so he could use it for a blanket. He switched off the light and sat there in the darkened compartment with his eyes closed, hoping sleep would come. After what seemed a long time, and just when he thought he was going to drop off, the train began to slow. It came to a stop at a little station outside of Basel. There, a middle-aged man in a dark suit and wearing a hat entered the compartment. The man said something to Myers in a language Myers didn't understand, and then the man put his leather bag into the rack. He sat down on the other side of the compartment and straightened his shoulders. Then he pulled his hat over his eyes. By the time the train was moving again, the man was asleep and snoring quietly. Myers envied him. In a few minutes, a Swiss official opened the door of the compartment and turned on the light. In English, and in some other language, German, Myers assumed, the official asked to see their passports. The man in the compartment with Myers pushed the hat back on his head, blinked his eyes, and reached into his coat pocket. The official studied the passport, looked at the man closely, and gave him back the document. Myers handed over his own passport. The official read the data, examined the photograph, and then looked at Myers before nodding and giving it back. He turned off the light as he went out. The man across from Myers pulled the hat over his eyes and put out his legs. Myers supposed he'd go right back to sleep, and once again he felt envy. He stayed awake after that and began to think of the meeting with his son, which was now only a few hours away. How would he act when he saw the boy at the station? Should he embrace him? He felt uncomfortable with that prospect. or should he merely offer his hand, smile as if these 8 years had never occurred, and then pat the boy on the shoulder? Maybe the boy would say a few words. "I'm glad to see you. How was your trip?" And Myers would say something. He really didn't know what he was going to say. The French contrôleur walked by the compartment. He looked in on Myers and at the man sleeping across from Myers. The same contrôleur had already punched their tickets, so Myers turned his head and went back to looking out the window. More houses began to appear. But now there were no walls, and the houses were smaller and set closer together. Soon, Myers was sure, he'd see a French village. The haze was lifting. The train blew its whistle and sped past a crossing over which a barrier had been lowered. He saw a young woman with her hair pinned up and wearing a sweater, standing with her bicycle as she watched the cars whip past. "How's your mother?" he might say to the boy after they had walked a little way from the station. "What do you hear from your mother?" For a wild instant it occurred to Myers she could be dead. But then he understood that it couldn't be so. He'd have heard something. One way or the other he'd have heard. He knew if he let himself go on thinking about these things, his heart could break. He closed the top button of his shirt and fixed his tie. He laid his coat across the seat next to him. He laced his shoes, got up, and stepped over the legs of the sleeping man. He let himself out of the compartment. Myers had to put his hand against the windows along the corridor to steady himself as he moved toward the end of the car. He closed the door to the little toilet and locked it. Then he ran water and splashed his face. The train moved into a curve, still at the same high speed, and Myers had to hold onto the sink for balance. The boy's letter had come to him a couple of months ago. The letter had been brief. He wrote that he'd been living in France and studying for the past year at the university in Strasbourg. There was no other information about what had possessed him to go to France, or what he'd been doing with himself during those years before France. Appropriately enough, Myers thought, no mention was made in the letter of the boy's mother, not a clue to her condition or whereabouts. But inexplicably, the boy had closed the letter with the word love, and Myers had pondered this for a long while. Finally, he'd answered the letter. After some deliberation, Myers wrote to say he had been thinking for some time of making a little trip to Europe. Would the boy like to meet him at the station in Strasbourg? He signed his letter, Love, Dad. He'd heard back from the boy, and then he made his arrangements. It struck him that there was really no one, besides his secretary and a few business associates, that he felt it was necessary to tell he was going away. He had accumulated 6 weeks of vacation at the engineering firm where he worked, and he decided he would take all of the time coming to him for this trip. He was glad he'd done this, even though he now had no intention of spending all that time in Europe. He'd gone first to Rome, but after the first few hours walking around by himself on the streets, he was sorry he hadn't arranged to be with a group. He was lonely. He went to Venice, a city he and his wife had always talked of visiting, but Venice was a disappointment. He saw a man with one arm eating fried squid, and there were grimy, water-stained buildings everywhere he looked. He took a train to Milan, where he checked into a 4-star hotel and spent the night watching a soccer match on a Sony color TV until the station went off the air. He got up the next morning and wandered around the city until it was time to go to the station. He'd planned the stopover in Strasbourg as the culmination of his trip. After a day or two, or 3 days, he'd see how it went, he would travel to Paris and fly home. He was tired of trying to make himself understood to strangers and would be glad to get back. Someone tried the door to the WC. Myers finished tucking his shirt. He fastened his belt. Then he unlocked the door and, swaying with the movement of the train, walked back to his compartment. As he opened the door, he saw at once that his coat had been moved. It lay across a different seat from the one where he'd left it. He felt he had entered into a ludicrous but potentially serious situation. His heart began to race as he picked up the coat. He put his hand into the inside pocket and took out his passport. He carried his wallet in his hip pocket, so he still had his wallet and the passport. He went through the other coat pockets. What was missing was the gift he'd bought for the boy, an expensive Japanese wristwatch purchased at a shop in Rome. He had carried the watch in his inside coat pocket for safekeeping. Now the watch was gone. "Pardon," he said to the man who slumped in the seat, legs out, hat over his eyes. "Pardon." The man pushed the hat back and opened his eyes. He pulled himself up and looked at Myers. His eyes were large. He might have been dreaming, but he might not. Myers said, "Did you see somebody come in here?" But it was clear the man didn't know what Myers was saying. He continued to stare at him with what Myers took to be a look of total incomprehension. But maybe it was something else, Myers thought. Maybe the look masked slyness and deceit. Myers shook his coat to focus the man's attention. Then he put his hand into the pocket and rummaged. He pulled his sleeve back and showed the man his own wristwatch. The man looked at Myers and then at Myers's watch. He seemed mystified. Myers tapped the face of his watch. He put his other hand back into his coat pocket and made a gesture as if he were fishing for something. Myers pointed at the watch once more and waggled his fingers, hoping to signify the wristwatch taking flight out the door. The man shrugged and shook his head. "God damn it," Myers said in frustration. He put his coat on and went out into the corridor. He couldn't stay in the compartment another minute. He was afraid he might strike the man. He looked up and down the corridor as if hoping he could see and recognize the thief. But there was no one around. Maybe the man who shared his compartment hadn't taken the watch. Maybe someone else, the person who tried the door to the WC, had walked past the compartment, spotted the coat and the sleeping man, and simply opened the door, gone through the pockets, closed the door, and gone away again. Myers walked slowly to the end of the car, peering into other compartments. It was not crowded in this first-class car, but there were one or two people in each compartment. Most of them were asleep, or seemed to be. Their eyes were closed, and their heads were thrown back against the seats. In one compartment, a man about his own age sat by the window, looking out at the countryside. When Myers stopped at the glass and looked in at him, the man turned and regarded him fiercely. Myers crossed into the second-class car. The compartments in this car were crowded, sometimes five or six passengers in each, and the people, he could tell at a glance, were more desperate. Many of them were awake. It was too uncomfortable to sleep. And they turned their eyes on him as he passed. Foreigners, he thought. It was clear to him that if the man in his compartment hadn't taken the watch, then the thief was from one of these compartments. But what could he do? It was hopeless. The watch was gone. It was in someone else's pocket now. He couldn't hope to make the contrôleur understand what had happened. And even if he could, then what? He made his way back to his own compartment. He looked in and saw that the man had stretched out again with his hat over his eyes. Myers stepped over the man's legs and sat down in his seat by the window. He felt dazed with anger. They were on the outskirts of the city now. Farms and grazing land had given over to industrial plants with unpronounceable names on the fronts of the buildings. The train began slowing. Myers could see automobiles on city streets and others waiting in line at crossings for the train to pass. He got up and took his suitcase down. He held it on his lap while he looked out the window at this hateful place. It came to him that he didn't want to see the boy after all. He was shocked by this realization, and for a moment felt diminished by the meanness of it. He shook his head. In a lifetime of foolish actions, this trip was possibly the most foolish thing he'd ever done. But the fact was, he really had no desire to see this boy whose behavior had long ago isolated him from Myers's affections. He suddenly and with great clarity recalled the boy's face when he had lunged that time, and a wave of bitterness passed over Myers. This boy had devoured Myers's youth, had turned the young girl he had courted and wed into a nervous, alcoholic woman whom the boy alternately pitied and bullied. Why on earth, Myers asked himself, would he come all this way to see someone he disliked? He didn't want to shake the boy's hand, the hand of his enemy, nor have to clap him on the shoulder and make small talk. He didn't want to have to ask him about his mother. He sat forward in the seat as the train pulled into the station. An announcement was called out in French over the train's intercom. The man across from Myers began to stir. He adjusted his hat and sat up in the seat as something else in French came over the speaker. Myers didn't understand anything that was said. He grew more agitated as the train slowed and then came to a stop. He decided he wasn't going to leave the compartment. He was going to sit where he was until the train pulled away. When it did, he'd be on it, going on with the train to Paris, and that would be that. He looked out the window cautiously, afraid he'd see the boy's face at the glass. He didn't know what he'd do if that happened. He was afraid he might shake his fist. He saw a few people on the platform wearing coats and scarves who stood next to their suitcases, waiting to board the train. A few other people waited without luggage, hands in their pockets, obviously expecting to meet someone. His son was not one of those waiting. But, of course, that didn't mean he wasn't out there somewhere. Myers moved the suitcase off his lap onto the floor and inched down in his seat. The man across from him was yawning and looking out the window. Now he turned his gaze on Myers. He took off his hat and ran his hand through his hair. Then he put the hat back on, got to his feet, and pulled his bag down from the rack. He opened the compartment door. But before he went out, he turned around and gestured in the direction of the station.
"Strasbourg," the man said.
Myers turned away. The man waited an instant longer and then went out into the corridor with his bag and, Myers felt certain, with the wristwatch. But that was the least of his concerns now. He looked out the train window once again. He saw a man in an apron standing in the door of the station smoking a cigarette. The man was watching two trainmen explaining something to a woman in a long skirt who held a baby in her arms. The woman listened and then nodded and listened some more. She moved the baby from one arm to the other. The men kept talking. She listened. One of the men chucked the baby under its chin. The woman looked down and smiled. She moved the baby again and listened some more. Myers saw a young couple embracing on the platform a little distance from his car. Then the young man let go of the young woman. He said something, picked up his valise, and moved to board the train. The woman watched him go. She brought a hand up to her face, touched one eye and then the other with the heel of her hand. In a minute, Myers saw her moving down the platform, her eyes fixed on his car, as if following someone. He glanced away from the woman and looked at the big clock over the station's waiting room. He looked up and down the platform. The boy was nowhere in sight. It was possible he had overslept, or it might be that he, too, had changed his mind. In any case, Myers felt relieved. He looked at the clock again, then at the young woman who was hurrying to the window where he sat. Myers drew back as if she were going to strike the glass. The door to the compartment opened. The young man he'd seen outside closed the door behind him and said, "Bonjour." Without waiting for a reply, he threw his valise under the overhead rack and stepped over to the window. "Pardonnez-moi." He pulled the window down. "Marie," he said. The young woman began to smile and cry at the same time. The young man brought her hands up and began kissing her fingers. Myers looked away and clamped his teeth. He heard the final shouts of the trainmen. Someone blew a whistle. Presently, the train began to move away from the platform. The young man had to let go of the woman's hands, but he continued to wave at her as the train rolled forward. But the train went only a short distance into the open air of the rail yard, and then Myers felt it come to an abrupt stop. The young man closed the window and moved over to the seat by the door. He took a newspaper from his coat and began to read. Myers got up and opened the door. He went to the end of the corridor where the cars were coupled together. He didn't know why they had stopped. Maybe something was wrong. He moved to the window, but all he could see was an intricate system of tracks where trains were being made up, cars taken off or switched from one train to another. He stepped back from the window. The sign on the door to the next car said, "Poussez." Myers struck the sign with his fist and the door slid open. He was in the second-class car again. He passed along a row of compartments filled with people settling down, as if making ready for a long trip. He needed to find out from someone where this train was going. He had understood, at the time he purchased the ticket, that the train to Strasbourg went on to Paris. But he felt it would be humiliating to put his head into one of the compartments and say Paris, or however they said it, as if asking if they'd arrived at a destination. He heard a loud clanking, and the train backed up a little. He could see the station again, and once more he thought of his son. Maybe he was standing back there, breathless from having rushed to get to the station, wondering what had happened to his father. Myers shook his head. The car he was in creaked and groaned under him. Then something caught and fell heavily into place. Myers looked out at the maze of tracks and realized that the train had begun to move again. He turned and hurried back to the end of the car and crossed back into the car he'd been traveling in. He walked down the corridor to his compartment. But the young man with the newspaper was gone, and Myers's suitcase was gone. It was not his compartment after all. He realized with a start they must have uncoupled his car while the train was in the yard and attached another second-class car to the train. The compartment he stood in front of was nearly filled with small, dark-skinned men who spoke rapidly in a language Myers had never heard before. One of the men signaled him to come inside. Myers moved into the compartment, and the men made room for him. There seemed to be a jovial air in the compartment. The man who'd signaled him laughed and patted the space next to him. Myers sat down with his back to the front of the train. The countryside out the window began to pass faster and faster. For a moment, Myers had the impression of the landscape shooting away from him. He was going somewhere, he knew that. And if it was the wrong direction, sooner or later he'd find it out. He leaned against the seat and closed his eyes. The men went on talking and laughing. Their voices came to him as if from a distance. Soon the voices became part of the train's movements, and gradually Myers felt himself being carried, then pulled back into sleep. A Small Good Thing. Saturday afternoon, she drove to the bakery in the shopping center. After looking through a loose-leaf binder with photographs of cakes taped onto the pages, she ordered chocolate, the child's favorite. The cake she chose was decorated with a spaceship and launching pad under a sprinkling of white stars and a planet made of red frosting at the other end. His name, Scotty, would be in green letters beneath the planet. The baker, who was an older man with a thick neck, listened without saying anything when she told